Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and look into the continuing political tension and stalemate in Iran. We'll be joined by Sir Richard Dalton, who was Associate Fellow at the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House in London. He is the United Kingdom's former ambassador to Iran from 2002 to 2006 and was also Britain's ambassador to Libya from 1996 to 2002. And then we will talk with Matt Taibbi, who's an investigative journalist, political writer and author who writes for Rolling Stone. He has an article in the current issue, The Great American Bubble Machine, which is about the inordinate power on Wall Street of Goldman Sachs. And, of course, the article was criticized by Goldman Sachs, but seems to have been vindicated by recent articles just 2 days ago in both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, questioning the enormous profits in the quarterly profits announced by Goldman Sachs of $3.4 billion and J.P. Morgan $2.7 billion. So I'll be talking with the author of that investigation into Goldman Sachs. And then we will, with this week's Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, delivered a blistering speech in Chicago against the extra buy of F-22 fighters that the Pentagon does not want, and President Obama has threatened to veto. However, the extra buy is being pushed by two liberal senators, Senator Edward Kennedy and Senator John Kerry. So I'll be talking with Pierre Spray, who's a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, and he was the primary designer on two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. So we'll be talking with a designer of aircraft about what many people believe is a Cold War relic, the F-22. Let's now turn to the subject of Iran, and I'm joined by Sir Richard Dalton, who is the Associate Fellow at the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House in London. He was formerly the United Kingdom's ambassador to Iran from 2002 to 2006 and Britain's ambassador to Libya from 1999 to 2002. And Sir Richard Dalton, it seems pretty clear that the people behind the scenes in the last decade or so in Iran, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, have been the power behind the scenes. And recently, in the aftermath of this election in Iran, it seems that they've just stepped out from behind the curtain, if you will, and are sort of rather brazenly running the place. Does that fit with your analysis?
Hello, Richard Dalton here. Yes, I think the Revolutionary Guard have played an important role in reestablishing what the Iranian system now calls peace and order, and they have said, their leadership have said, that they were invited to do that. Now, this is the role allocated to them over the decades. I mean, they were set up in the 1980s to be both an internal and an external force, and they are, in many ways, the ultimate guarantor of the regime. And they've been used in that capacity when it looked as though the demonstrations might be going to pick up a serious amount of weight. Whether or not this means that over the last period the Revolutionary Guard have been, in effect, a government behind the scenes is an open question, and analysts disagree on it. I think that Iran is still run by the supreme leader, who takes advice from a variety of quarters, including that of the Revolutionary Guards. Admittedly, their privileges have grown. People who have served with them have recently been put into very important positions, but that doesn't mean that this is a military dictatorship. Iran is more complex than that.
So would there be an analogy with Putin's Russia in the extent to which the sort of KGB alumnus seem to be in all the key positions?
Yes, I think you can say that, but it's not clear to me in Iran whether the fact that somebody used to be a senior commander in the Revolutionary Guards means that in a new civil capacity as a regional governor, for example, or a minister or deputy minister, that person is taking orders from a military leadership. I'm inclined to think that it may mean that there's a community of thinking and of feeling and of ideology, but it doesn't mean that the way Iran is run has fundamentally changed.
I'm speaking with Britain's, United Kingdom's former ambassador to Iran, Sir Richard Dalton, and the when you mentioned a minute ago that the supreme leader is essentially in control, he apparently doesn't have the kind of religious credibility that the Khomeini had, for example, or anything like it. But I understand that his son is a key player, and he may be a link to the Revolutionary Guard Corps, Mujtaba.
Yes, that is being said, particularly by demonstrators. Evidence isn't readily available. I mean, there's no doubt that any top man in any country has got people who act as links to key institutions and transmit his wishes and bring back requests for advice. And it could well be that that's the sort of behind-the-scenes role which Ayatollah Khamenei has entrusted to his son Mujtaba.
So it's pretty clear that we here in the United States don't have a lot of intelligence on the ground, and it's sort of paradoxical, perhaps, that the countries that were all singled out by the last administration and some of the neoconservative thinkers in that administration who came up with this notion of the axis of evil, North Korea, Iraq, and Iran, in all cases, we're pretty blind. Since you were the ambassador to Britain's ambassador to Iran from 2002 to 2006, Sir Richard Dalton, it seems that for some reason or other, the regime now of Ahmadinejad is going after Britain. Now, is it possible that a subtext in the fact that they're singling out embassy workers and others, and particularly BBC reporters, blaming them, for example, for instigating these street protests, is it possible that this rumor that the British government seized about £1 billion of Mujtaba Khamenei's accounts in London may have provoked that?
I know nothing whatsoever about that. It sounds highly unlikely. I think Iran is full of rumors at the moment, and I haven't picked up any substance behind that one. Mm. The fact is that when things don't go right in Iran, it's a regular tactic to look for a foreign enemy and to blame that person, whether or not there's any solid evidence for the misdeed that foreign enemy is alleged to have carried out or not. And in my experience, Britain was accused of a great many things which it had never done, and it was given an importance in Iranian domestic affairs by such people which was totally fanciful. In many ways, it's a cop-out. The Iranian people, the Iranian system has been responsible for its own fate for decades, and yet the idea that there's a big conspiracy and that Britain is prominent in that conspiracy still attracts a lot of support. And we see this idea of a conspiracy trotted out, as I said, when things don't go right.
Well, would that mean then, Sir Richard Dalton, that President Obama has, in spite of public opinion being against Ahmadinejad and a general belief that that a coup has taken place there, and there's a lot of support, obviously, for the victims of this coup, particularly when you see a young woman dying on the streets before your eyes. Nevertheless, he's kept the door open, if you will, to Ahmadinejad. And my question would be, therefore, if this regime likes to use foreign enemies to as an excuse for its failures, what motive would there be on Ahmadinejad's part to want to make a deal and end the enmity, or at least tamper it down, if indeed he relies on tensions between his country and the West?
Well, that's a very good question, and there's no doubt that there will be people in Iran who argue that it's much more in the interests of the Islamic Republic to remain at enmity with the United States than to seek an accommodation with the United States. But there are also strong voices that argue the opposite. And the reasons for that are that Iran is not in the place where its rulers want to see it. The international sanctions have an impact on Iran's economic relations with the rest of the world. The view that's taken of Iran's nuclear program in the Security Council may get even worse for Iran. There's a possibility that there would be additional measures taken. And then there's also the positive side, too. Iran needs, as a major country, good relations with the rest of the world if it's to prosper. Its economy has not done well. It's underperformed over the last few years, although there's been growth of 4%, 5%, that sort of thing. That's been down to rises in the price of oil, which have come to a halt. So not only are they finding it very difficult to reduce inflation and to create new jobs, but there's a big question mark over the future prospects of their oil and gas industry, on which the future of the Iranian system and, of course, the future prosperity of the Iranian people depend. And there is a strong school of thought, the realist school, some call it, which is that Iran will not be able to improve the prospect for its people unless it can reach some resolution of the many sources of tension that it has with the outside world. Now, what we don't know is whether the Supreme Leader is going to authorize the new government, which will be formed next month, to explore President Obama's hand of friendship and to resume negotiations with Russia, China, Britain, Germany, France, and the United States, or whether he's going to remain defiant. So it's just simply too soon to say whether the debate will come down in favor of exploring what the United States can offer, or whether they will continue to oppose it.
Well, wouldn't it make sense, Sir Richard Dalton, for the United States at this point to sort of see how the chips fall? I mean, it seems to me, and seems to many observers, that following Friday prayers, where Rafsanjani called for the release of prisoners and questioned the results of the elections, and of course that resulted in some backlash from the conservative clerics, like the Guardian council member Ayatollah Yazdi, who said, "Legitimacy and acceptance are different in Islamic government. Votes alone do not create legitimacy." Pretty stark. But of course, if Rafsanjani is to be the poster boy for reform, that has its problems because he's got some baggage vis-a-vis corruption, has he not?
Yes, he does. What question would you like me to address specifically there?
Well, I guess the question is, the overall question is, are things still in flux, and therefore should Obama just sort of wait to see how the chips fall?
I think that's exactly the policy which the United States has enunciated, particularly in the speech 2 days ago by Hillary Clinton. But the underlying interest of the United States, I believe, and certainly of Europe, is to maintain their negotiating offers on the table. I mean, the issues that are being dealt with in this negotiation, namely maximizing the chances that Iran will not become a nuclear weapons state, stabilizing the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, reducing tensions between Iran and its neighbors, maximizing the chances of a peaceful settlement over Palestine. These are very important issues, and standing out against Iran and refusing to talk has not served U.S. or world interests over the last few years. So I believe that the option of talking to Iran about these problems must be maintained, and that in due course, Iran's interest itself in exploring what might emerge from intensified discussions of that kind will reappear. It may take some time for the political dust to settle, as you say, but assuming it does, and the United States and its partners won't wait forever, but assuming it does, I think it should be possible to at least begin discussions of how dialogue might start.
And Sir Richard Dalton, since you were the British ambassador to Iran from 2002 to 2006, what's your reading on the state of flux? I mean, if it seems apparent that Ahmadinejad is trying to be a little more conciliatory. I believe his choice of a deputy, who apparently said some conciliatory words about Israel, may indicate that. But on the other hand, it seems that people are still banging pots at night, calling death to the dictator, and it seems, though, that the people in Iran were chafing under the theocracy, but the one thing that they had was at least a semblance of democracy, and now that that's been taken away from, I get the impression that they're quite surly.
Well, people are, but remember that the way in which Iran has been governed over the last few years has tended to emphasize the Islamic part of their constitution and to diminish the importance of the Republican part. The parliamentary elections in 2004, the elections to the Iranian Majlis, were marked by the disqualification of over 2,000 candidates, most of whom were regarded by the clerical elite as being too prone to want to reform the way Iran is run. And then in 2005, there was some suggestion by the defeated candidates there were irregularities. What history may come to say about this election is that the irregularities were not so much different in kind as different in scale. As to how opinion can be settled down now, the Iranian authorities have a choice, and it's not clear that they've yet made the choice. That is between continuing to tough it out, to stand on the results of the election, to appoint a government and try and get it accepted in the image of President Ahmadinejad's first term, or to find some compromise with the protesters, with the defeated presidential candidates, between the supporters of those defeated presidential candidates in the parliament and President Ahmadinejad. Now, you could call one option continuity, you could call the other option adjustment to the political controversy. At the moment, it's not clear that the people who call the shots at the top of the regime have decided which course to adopt. It could go either way, and it could be a stalemate for some time.
Well, just in closing, Sir Richard Dalton, you mentioned that the Islamic part of the Islamic Republic is what calls the shots, and the Republic part clearly is now in question because of this election. However, it seems that in terms of Islamists, it seems that the reformers, if that's the correct term, have more religious credibility. Rafsanjani being closer to Ayatollah Khamenei, Khamenei not having any particular religious credentials. Karoubi, who also ran, is himself an Ayatollah. And Mousavi, the reform candidate, has, I think, fairly solid Islamic credentials. So does that give the reformists some ammunition?
Yes, the reformists do have support amongst senior clerical figures, and the hardliners do too. And there's a larger body than either who are sitting on the fence. This is the impression that outside observers get. Whether this is accurate or not is hard to say, because we aren't able to look inside this world in which religious authority and politics meet in Iran. We can make an analysis of what we think most likely, and at the moment what I think is most likely is that the debate is continuing and that there is a stalemate. It's very hard to say yet whether those who think that religion, the Islamic way, points to emphasizing the Republican part of the Constitution are going to succeed. I mean, I have to say that Ayatollah Khamenei at the top of the system, the leader, declaring for Ahmadinejad in the way that he has, he's staked out a position which is going to be very hard for him to climb down from. I think what's interesting about former President Rafsanjani's speech is that he suggested a program to at least approach those questions, like releasing prisoners, like allowing a free debate on how Iran should be ruled in the media, about asserting that the system has credibility if people fully support it through the ballot box. I mean, this suggests to me that they've got a long way to go in this internal debate.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Sir Richard Dalton, and giving us your expertise on this subject about which we clearly need more information. And I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Sir Richard Dalton, who's the Associate Fellow of Middle East and North Africa Program at Chatham House in London. He was formerly the United Kingdom's ambassador to Iran from 2002 to 2006, and he was also Britain's ambassador to Libya from 1999 to 2002. Let's turn to the subject of Goldman Sachs, who just posted record quarterly profits, $3.4 billion. J.P. Morgan posted profits of $2.7 billion. And to some extent, the coverage of this extraordinary success, in quotes, of these companies that have essentially been bailed out by the taxpayer vindicates a recent article by Matt Taibbi in the Rolling Stone, the Great American Bubble Machine. Both the front page of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal in an editorial referred to Goldman Sachs as Goldie Bank. So Matt Taibbi, investigative journalist, political writer and author, currently works at the Rolling Stone, where he authors a column called Road Rage for the print version and an additional weekly online column called The Low Post. He's also the author of the bestseller The Great Derangement, a terrifying true story of war, politics and religion at the twilight of the American Empire. Do you feel vindicated, since Goldman Sachs were very upset with your article?
Yeah, they were, and their response both to me, and they've also had a critic online recently from a site called Zero Hedge, which in the past they've ignored basically their press critics, but now, you know, they've taken a shot at me, they've taken a shot at this other guy, and I think there's a sense that they're getting a little bit worried that criticism of the bank is spilling into the mainstream somewhat, and that's kind of new territory for them, and I think that's why you're seeing the response.
Well, that leads me to a real puzzlement, Mac Taibbi, and that is, why is it that these bankers, both at Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, all of these recipients of this vast amount of bailout money, first of all, they screwed their taxpayers. They screwed their creditors. They screwed their own employers. And now they're screwing the taxpayer who's bailing them out. They seem to have no shame. I mean, you get the impression from what happened at General Motors and Chrysler that a lot of those executives, and many of them gone on the record, with a certain amount of remorse. But,
right.
But these guys, forget it. What is it about these bankers that issues such arrogance?
Well, I think they're morally insane. Really, I mean, they're one of the problems that you run up against with this community is that a lot of them kind of live in a sort of cultural bubble within which there are a lot of people who believe very strongly in the sort of Adam Smith view of capitalism that, you know, greed is good, and the more money they make, you know, somehow or other, on the other end, it's going to work out to be positive for society. And they really believe that the more, you know, the better they are at their job, and their job is to make themselves money, that somehow they're doing their job in society. And that, and a lot of them are legitimately puzzled as to why people would be upset with them for, you know, giving themselves, you know, $11 billion in bonuses, you know, right on the heels of this enormous, massive government subsidy that we've been giving them in the last year. They just do not see the connection. They don't see what's wrong with that, and that's why they seem to be acting without shame, because it's just not part of their, you know, their professional profile.
But Matt Taibbi, they do not create wealth; they extract wealth.
Well, particularly in the last year, I think a lot of people are not really aware of the extent to which Wall Street has been propped up now by the government and by taxpayer money. The TARP, the bailout program that most people have heard about, which was, you know, legitimately just handing these banks taxpayer money from the Treasury, that's only a small slice of the government assistance these banks have been getting. There's actually a whole galaxy of other ways that we've been propping up the banks. In the case of Goldman Sachs, one of the major ones was the AIG bailout, because AIG owed Goldman about $20 billion when they went into their death spiral, and about at least $13 billion of the government bailout went straight to Goldman Sachs. But beyond that, there's a thing called the Temporary Liquidity Guarantee Program, which gives bank holding companies FDIC backing for any new debt they want to issue, which is basically like giving banks access to free money. I mean, they're able to borrow their money essentially for free, which means that when they lend it out to the rest of us at market rates, they're making an enormous amount of money on the spreads. And the other result of that that access to a free money is that interest rates for all of us go down. So all of us people who were doing the proper thing by saving money in banks, we're making maybe half of what we would have been making beforehand, and that money that we would have been making, all of us, on our savings, that's what those bonuses that Goldman Sachs is making this month are. That's where that money went. It's turned into bonuses for these bankers.
Again, I'm speaking with Matt Taibbi, whose current article in the current issue of Rolling Stone, The Great American Bubble Machine, From Tech Stocks to High Gas Prices, Goldman Sachs has engineered every major market manipulation since the Great Depression, and they're about to do it again. This is an article that caused Goldman Sachs a certain amount of heartburn. However, coverage in the mainstream press from the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal about the record profits just posted by Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan indicate that even Wall Street itself is starting to look askance at these big players. Walk us through, if you can, just briefly your thesis that their next target for a bubble is this cap and trade, which has just passed the House and has an uncertain fate in the Senate.
Goldman Sachs, in particular, is poised to take enormous advantage of cap and trade. The bank has spent about a little under $4 million last year lobbying for this bill, and in fact, cap and trade was actually a pet project of former Goldman chief Hank Paulson, who eventually became Bush's Treasury Secretary. If the government, with this cap and trade thing, they could have just levied a simple carbon tax. They could have taxed carbon emissions and collected the tax for carbon emissions. Instead, they created this enormously complex private commodities market, where banks are going to trade in carbon credits. Now, the banks have been positioning themselves to capitalize on this. Goldman is a part owner of the Chicago Climate Exchange, where these credits are going to be traded. They're also heavily invested in companies that produce and deal in carbon credits. So if and when this goes through, they're going to make an enormous amount of money, and that's going to be a hidden cost to all of us, because our energy prices are going to be going up as we subsidize this private market. And it's going to function almost exactly like the current commodities market, and it's going to be regulated in the same way. And we've already seen that the banks are enormously adept at manipulating the price of commodities like oil. You might remember that gasoline went over $4.50 a gallon last year, and that was sort of the same thing was at work there.
Well, that the gaming of the market 2 summers ago, was it last summer actually? Last summer when it the prices went up to $147 a barrel. Mm. That 60 Minutes did a piece on that where they laid it out pretty clearly that it was J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs, not Chevron and Exxon.
That's right. And in fact, the government more or less implicitly confirmed that thesis just a couple of weeks ago when they released a series of new reforms designed to curb the behavior that went on last summer. Last year, the price, the worldwide oil supply actually rose throughout the summer, and demand actually was falling throughout the year. So the price of gas should have actually been plummeting the entire year. Instead, it skyrocketed. And the reason for that was because after the housing market collapsed, banks like Goldman Sachs were funneling a lot of institutional investors and telling them, hey, you know, the housing market died. You need to go into something safe. You need to go into commodities. And so it created this enormous amount of speculative demand for oil futures in particular, to the point where at the height of the boom last summer, every barrel of oil that was consumed in the United States was traded 27 times before it was consumed. So all of that rise in price was purely artificial speculative demand and had nothing to do with the actual price, availability of oil. So when John McCain was telling us that we had to drill offshore to get more oil, that was completely based. It had nothing to do with that.
So you asked in this article, Matt Taibbi, The Great American Bubble Machine, you asked rhetorically, this should be pitchfork-level outrage. I mean, the idea that these people are essentially parasites and they're unpatriotic. They're milking the middle class and the working Americans unnecessarily by gouging them on gasoline, by setting them up in trick-laden mortgages. In fact, the great tragedy there is this, the aspiring poor and middle class, poor and working class people in this country, mostly minorities, in Bush's ownership society, thought that was their ticket into the middle class, and now they're living in their cars. It's extraordinary to think that so few people have caused so much damage. But it's then become bizarre when you think that these very people are still in charge, it seems.
Well, I think one of the things that's really interesting about this is that this community on Wall Street has been able to isolate itself from criticism, largely because the mechanism by which they achieve all of this is so incredibly complicated, and it's also so boring that it's really hard to communicate it to ordinary people exactly what's going on. And so they don't pay enough attention to it. And I think if they understood it better, they would be, furious. There would be riots in the street, but they don't. And it's we haven't gotten to the point where they will. I mean, the mortgage thing is a classic example. You know, what happened there was that banks like Goldman Sachs found a way to take these toxic mortgages, these mortgages that were designed to blow up, the option ARMs and things like that, to take them, chop them up, and turn them into securities and sell them off to secondary investors like pension funds and foreign teachers unions and things like that. Without that process, there would have been no market for those explosive mortgages, and none of this stuff would have happened. But it's incredibly complicated, that whole process, that securitization process. And so nobody understands it, and that's why they're not criticized for it. And I think that's only just starting to change now.
Well, clearly, the particularly Goldman Sachs have almost transcended politics in this country, and arguably, you could make the case that Wall Street runs Washington. You've had Rubin, a Democrat, running Goldman Sachs, and of course, he enabled a lot of getting rid of the Glass-Steagall, et cetera, under Clinton, and then, as you mentioned, Paulson under Bush. Does this explain, I think, a lot of people have been suspicious about the actions that have been taken in this financial meltdown on Wall Street, and at the time it was happening, many people I spoke to, like Rubini and others, were saying that this will end up making Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan stronger, and that is the evidence that's right before us now, is it not?
Absolutely. First of all, obviously the connections between Goldman Sachs and the government are enormous and pervasive, and we would they're so lengthy it would be impossible to list them. I mean, you mentioned Rubin and Paulson, but the current chief of staff of the Treasury is a former Goldman banker. The head of the CFTC, which regulates commodities, is a former Goldman banker. The head of the World Bank, the Bank of Canada, the Bank of Italy, the New York Stock Exchange, the New York Federal Reserve, which is the primary regulator of Goldman Sachs, is a former Goldman Sachs banker. These connections go on and on. They're everywhere. And, what happened last year, Goldman Sachs actually might have gone out of business last summer if AIG had been allowed to proceed to an ordinary bankruptcy because AIG owed it so much money. Instead, what happened was that, you know, Goldman was able to have a dialogue with the former head of Goldman Sachs, Hank Paulson, at the Treasury, who then bails out AIG, who bails out Goldman. And simultaneously to that, he allowed Lehman Brothers, which is Goldman's biggest competitor, to die that same week. So Goldman, instead of, you know, going out of business, ended up triumphant because it lost its biggest competitor and it gained $13 billion taxpayer dollars all in the same week. And that doesn't happen if they didn't have those unique connections, I don't think.
So, Matt Taibbi, what is going to create sufficient outrage? You're suggesting that people just simply aren't educated, that these are like sort of shamans who keep the secrets in the cave, and we're just seeing the shadows here in a kind of shadow puppetry. What will it take, do you think? Is it education of the public to understand how much they're getting hosed? Because it seems that, and I mentioned that Wall Street Journal had an editorial and an article, I think it was Friday, by a hedge fund manager, both being very critical of Goldman Sachs, saying that at the end of the day, they're bailing out these predators on Wall Street and they're doing nothing about Main Street. They're crowding out the capital market.
Yeah, and, you know, I can speak to this because, you know, I'm one of those reporters, mainstream political reporters, who has blown off this financial story for years because I didn't understand it. I know for a fact, because I was there, that, you know, when we cover the campaign trail and we cover politicians in this country, you know, when we cover the economy, typically what we do is we say, hey, the NYSE is going up, the banks are reporting profits, that's good news for the economy. That's about as far as financial analysis goes for the mainstream political press. But I think that's changing now. I think, you know, what Goldman and JP Morgan and Bank of America did this week, it's a little bit akin to, you know, somebody who cheats at a casino getting caught because they did it too many times. They were too greedy. If they were a little bit less greedy, they would never have been caught. They wouldn't have stood out. But what happened this week with these enormous profit numbers in the wake of these subsidies, it's caused such tremendous outrage, even within Wall Street, even among the shareholders of these companies, that now there's going to be this light shining on all these companies, and people are going to start asking questions. Where did this money come from? What role did state subsidies play? And I think, you know, now that George Bush and Dick Cheney are no longer there to be the sort of bogeymen of progressive America, I think these guys are stepping into that new villain role, and I think we're going to start to see some more attention paid, and I think that's good.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles today, Matt Taibbi.
Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Matt Taibbi, investing journalist, political writer, and author. He has an article in the current issue of Rolling Stone, The Great American Bubble Machine. Let's now turn to the subject of the F-22 fighter. The Liberal senators are asking the taxpayer to buy more of this flying turkey. I'm speaking with Pierre Spray, who is a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. Mr. Spray was the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. He left the Pentagon in 1986, and when he left, he said it became increasingly obvious that the atmosphere in the Pentagon was such that it would be impossible to build another honest aircraft. He is the owner of Maple Shades Records and enjoyed considerable success when one of his recordings was used by Kanye West for the mega hit Jesus Walks. And this week, Pierre Spray, Secretary of Defense Gates, gave a speech in Chicago where he castigated Senate, I guess, for adding $1.75 billion for seven more F-22 fighters above the 187 that they've bought already. And curiously enough, the senators who are pressing for these extra fighters that the Pentagon and President Obama doesn't want and has threatened to veto are Senator Edward Kennedy and Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts. So does this prove that the military-industrial complex is an equal trough at which both Democrats and Republicans feed?
Beyond the shadow of a doubt. And, of course, that's been true for a long time. it's worse today than it's ever been. But this blame for the military-industrial complex can certainly be heaped equally on Republicans and Democrats. There's no question.
And, of course, Gates said the obvious, that the more they buy stuff we don't need, the less we have available for the stuff we do need. And I guess what he's referring to here is that the F-22s, which is a Cold War fighter designed for aerial supremacy against the Soviet Air Force, we don't need any more of these things, and we can certainly get into the technical side of why this is not a particularly good airplane to begin with, the F-22. But clearly, Gates has been trying to get more of these unmanned aircraft, which have proven to be much more useful in the kinds of theaters that the United States finds itself in, Iraq and Afghanistan.
I beg to differ, but I'm totally with Secretary Gates on the need to stop expenditures on stuff that's irrelevant, doesn't work, and in essence is a betrayal of our troops. I mean, buying F-22s is a betrayal of our troops because it keeps us from buying things they really need in favor of stuff that, you know, poor Congress senators want. And of course, the industry has paid for richly. On the other hand, Gates's backing of the drones, the unmanned vehicles, is ridiculous. That's just from his old CIA background. Those things are just as counterproductive as unnecessary fighters or bombers that create more volunteers for the Taliban.
Indeed, did you? I don't know whether you caught the op-ed in the New York Times recently by David Kilcullen, who's the chief counterterrorism advisor to General Petraeus and to former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago, and he said that the Predators have a 2% success rate. In other words, for every two high-value terrorist targets you take out, 98 civilians, innocent civilians, are killed.
He's totally on the money. Exactly correct. This is it. You know, there's a larger issue at stake, which is simply bombing of enemy homeland, enemy civilians, enemy infrastructure is the most counterproductive of all the military missions we've undertaken, not to mention the most expensive also. But it's been true in every war. It's not just true in this war, that kind of bombing that's not part of the fire and movement of troops on the ground and closely integrated with exactly what they're doing, that kind of bombing is not only a waste of money, it actually hardens the enemy's resolve and lengthens the war. And that's exactly what it's doing in Afghanistan. And the Predator is part of that. And Gates is dead wrong in saying that we don't need F-22s, but we do need unmanned vehicles.
Well, of course, what's interesting about how difficult it is for history to be taken seriously, the Strategic Bombing Survey after World War II, a couple of very prominent Americans were involved in that, the great economist John Kenneth Galbraith, mm-hmm. and former Secretary of State George Ball, and yep. both of them throughout their lives kept pointing this out, and particularly during the Vietnam War, that we've already been down this path. I mean, it's sort of what the historian Barbara Tuchman referred to as the March of Folly.
Yes.
What's the disconnect here between the historical record and the fact that we keep, as Einstein says, if you keep doing the same thing and expect different results, that's a definition of insanity.
It is. I mean, this is not insane. This is perfectly rational because it's about money. If the huge amount of money being spent on airplanes wasn't fueling this recurring insanity, it wouldn't happen. You know, so it's not that it's simply, you know, mass irrationality on the part of the American people, the American military. It's that there are people who are making a huge amount of money out of continuing bombing and who use, you know, pork-seeking senators and congressmen, not to mention, you know, presidents and administrations, to do their, you know, to accomplish their aims, which is to make money.
Well, to give
the hell with the fighting man and the hell with the pilot and the hell with the sailor.
Well, to give the president his due, Barack Obama has threatened to veto this defense bill.
Absolutely.
If these extra...
I give him high marks for having done that. Unfortunately, he's appointed a Pentagon full of people who are of the opposite persuasion, who are in fact part of the industry and want to keep on spending, sadly.
So what do you expect to happen next week when the Senate has its vote, and if indeed they add these extra airplanes that the Pentagon doesn't want, and that the president has threatened to veto? Representative Murtha suggested a compromise will be reached. Of course, compromise is that dirty word that's celebrated in Washington.
Compromise usually equals sellout. And coming from Murtha, it's guaranteed to be an attempted sellout. You know, he's only a step away from a jail cell.
Well, yes, it turns out his brother Kit is the bag man, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure he's not the... I would guess he's not the only one. But, you know.
Well, that's kind of close to home, isn't it? So, Pierre, since you designed the two of the more successful aircraft in the United States Air Force, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet, give us your technical assessment of the F-22, the one that we've already spent, I don't know what the figure is now, I wish I had it for me, it's been huge, it's one of the most expensive planes ever. We've bought 187 of them, and this new appropriation of $1.75 billion is for seven more, and it's being pushed, as I mentioned, by Senators Kennedy and Senator John Kerry, both of Massachusetts.
Right. Well, the airplane, of course, is being sold as the magic bullet that makes any other fighter in the world disappear instantly. It is the opposite of a magic bullet. Every extra F-22 that we buy actually weakens American air power. First and foremost, for the simple reason that every war we've ever been in, every air war we've ever been in, has taught us that pilots count for more than any other factor in air combat. Pilot ability is far more important than whether you have the glitziest airplane or a 10-year-old airplane or a 20-year-old airplane. And that's been true for us. It was true for our enemies. It's true for the Israelis. It's simply a fact of war. Every extra F-22 that we buy means our pilots get less trained. The airplane is so appallingly complex to fly and to maintain that our pilots are only getting 10 to 12 hours a month. It's grossly inadequate. The Israeli Air Force, at the peak of its abilities in the 70s, when it was getting 15 to 1 and 30 to 1 exchange ratios against Arabs, felt a need to train their pilots 40 to 60 hours. You know, even we, who have been very skimpy with pilot training, particularly during austere times like the 70s, were giving our pilots 20 to 30 hours a month. Poor guys are down to 10 to 12. That means they're totally unprepared for combat. It doesn't matter how great their airplane is. We have greatly increased the likelihood of their losses if they ever have to fight in that thing.
Well, there's an alternative aircraft available that's in the pipeline, the F-35, that Secretary Gates argues is better, cheaper, and more effective.
Totally wrong. That's just his form of sellout. Mm-hmm. In order to kill the F-22, he's backed an airplane that's even worse. The F-35 is exactly the same mistake as the F-22, writ slightly smaller. So instead of costing $350 million, that Turkey might cost $200 or $250 million. It's even more unmaneuverable, even less agile, and by the way, totally oriented to bombing, which the F-22 is not. So it's in no sense a substitute or in any sense a cure for what ails American air power. It's just more of the same. And Gates has just made a decision to try to kill one and keep Lockheed happy. Lockheed, by the way, is the manufacturer of the F-35 as well as the F-22. So It's just, you know, it's just another seedy horse trade.
I see. What about the Super Hornet? Doesn't that have a lot of shelf life ahead of it? I mean, in other words,
that was a loser from the start. was the airplane that lost the competition to the F-16, and the Navy picked it up because they couldn't stand the idea of buying an Air Force airplane.
Oh, Lord.
And they took the loser and made it worse. It's far worse than the than the version that lost to the F-16.
So this is...
No, I mean, first
this
of
is
all,
the,
inter- we don't particularly need a new air-to-air fighter. Right? There's no looming fabulous air-to-air fighter in the hands of China, Russia, or anybody else. The F-16, ancient as it is in fact, you know, quite adequate to the task, more than adequate, probably better than the F-22, and it certainly allows pilots to train enough to develop the skills they need to win and survive in combat. So fundamentally, there's no need right now for another air-to-air fighter. If there was, the obviously sensible thing to do would be to build a highly modern version of the F-16. It would way outdo plane for plane the F-22 if we needed it, and I suspect there isn't anybody in the Pentagon who would stand up and say, you know, we simply need lots more new air-to-air fighters. Obviously, we badly need other things for the troops, including close support, which we have no airplane at all for, barring the ancient A-10, which the Air Force is trying to unload.
They never liked that from the beginning, even though it's turned out to be one of the most successful platforms there is.
Of course, because they hate the mission. The Air Force, the last thing in the world the Air Force ever wants to do is support soldiers on the ground. Air Force generals would much rather fight their own bombing war. Now we're back to bombing again and the uselessness of that. But they like it for bureaucratic reasons as well as for money reasons.
So you're arguing that well, you're making a case that everything since the F-16 has been a turkey, and that...
An astonishing turkey at astonishing expense. I mean, think about it. If we built a stripped-down F-16 today, it would be a quarter the size of this huge, lumbering F-22, and it would cost a tenth as much. We were building it in quantity.
But what about this stealth
character?
It shows
you how appallingly we've perverted the whole airplane development process. It's not like it's hard to design a great fighter, you know, but it takes a lot of discipline and it takes rejecting a lot of junk that's trendy or that's going to make a lot of money for people.
But what about this stealth characteristic then that's much, much touted?
That's a fraud. It's almost unspeakable. That's the hook for making it look like all previous generations of airplanes are obsolete. The fact of the matter is that the Russians, since the 50s, have had, you know, well over 1,000 radars at any one time that are completely immune to stealth, that absolutely, you know, see right through whatever modicum of cloaking stealth does. Long wavelength radars of very old vintage and very old technology, which the Russians continue to produce to this day, and for good reason, are totally immune to the stealth coatings, the stealth shapings, all the technology that stealth involves leave these radars unaffected, and they can see, you know, fighters like the F-22 at hundreds of miles. And stealth does work under an extraordinarily limited set of conditions, which in essence means it doesn't work in combat. It works if you're head-on to a radar, you know, which is in this essence almost useless since the sky is full of hundreds of radars, most of which are not head-on, and you can't be head-on to all of them at once, or if you're wings level showing the edge of your fuselage to those radars. But flying wings level in combat for more than 15 seconds is a sure road to getting killed. As soon as you turn, roll your wing to bank, you're hugely visible to every radar, not only the old-fashioned long-wavelength radars, but the new air-to-air radars. So the whole thing is like a scam to make old airplanes obsolete and to create an excuse for spending the $65 billion or so that we've spent on the F-22.
So that means the B-2 is also a fraud, right?
Of course it's a fraud. You know, and the same radars that I just referred to, some ancient, some new, but, you know, in the thousands, see the B-2 every time it flies.
Mm.
Have no trouble whatsoever.
So the...
And by the way, this is a fraud that goes back, this happens to be a democratic fraud, it goes back to Bill Perry as the head of R&D for Carter.
Yeah, I remember Carter.
And he introduced this stealth fraud in order to put across two of his favorite projects, the cruise missile, and to kill the Republican bomber, which was the B-1, and to start the Democratic bomber, which was the B-2.
Well, Pierre Spray, this is a depressing conversation for the for the taxpayer.
It is indeed.
But obviously the taxpayer is not particularly educated about these things. Certainly, I haven't heard this information before. And you're not telling me this just because you designed the F-16.
No. And by the way, you know, within a year after the F-16 had flown, I and my colleagues had already designed a vastly better airplane because we thought it was far from perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how you make advances in airplanes.
Right.
You figure out what's wrong with the last one and what you did wrong, and you do something better. That's, you know, there's none of that left in the aircraft industry. But before we wrap up, though, let me just urge you and all your listeners to send a letter, a telegram, a phone call, or anything to
email
California senators, because they're just as pork-ridden as Kennedy and Murtha
and Kerry, right.
And the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein are busy pushing their own brand of pork, which for California happens to be the C-17, a totally useless cargo airplane. So they're in this up to their necks, too. Send them a note and tell them you're tired of it.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Pierre Spray.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Pierre Spray, a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. Mr. Spray was the primary designer on two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. He's the owner of Maple Shade Records and enjoyed considerable success when one of his recordings was used by Kanye West in the mega hit Jesus Walks. And I'd like to thank the producers, Alan Minsky and Louis Vandenberg, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Anthony Castillo, the assistant producer here today with us, and Melisa Figueroa, the engineer.